All right, come then in this lecture to part two of apologetics, historical introduction, and I have something to say just briefly about general introduction here. I want to say something about divisions of church history. Usually the study of church history is surveyed to the usual four divisions of church history: early, medieval, Reformation, and modern. The way I do it in the courses on that subject in RBST. But as I have reflected upon the best way to survey historical theology for our present purposes, it's appeared to me that an alternate threefold division of historical theology will be more satisfactory. Therefore, we will look at Christian apologetics and theological epistemology in Section 1, the Early Church, Section 2, the Augustinian Church, and Section 3, the Modern Church, and that also is a common way of dividing church history. Secondly, thing I want to talk about is the alternatives of church history. And that is simply to say that two great perspectives about defending the faith become visible in church history. They constitute the two alternatives which must be evaluated in light of the Word of God. To understand the nature and development of those two alternatives, you must begin at the beginning in the history of the early church, and by means of six key figures, survey their development throughout the entirety of church history. In each of the three periods of church history, the contrasting views of two of these key figures will be set before us. In this way, I hope we'll better understand these two views and their development. This understanding will help us ask the right questions of our answer key, the Bible. In this way, we'll be able to develop a biblical, I hope, and balanced view of apologetics, because we'll have both the insights of exegetical and historical theology in front of us when we come to look at the Scriptures. All right, so some of you who've been in the Sunday school class know that I do everything I'm going to do in about the next six lectures in one Sunday school class, which is probably harder on the class and harder on me as well. But at any rate, I do think that the general structure of that Sunday school class is quite helpful, because we're going to contrast in the early church Justin Martyr and Tertullian. In the medieval church, we're going to contrast Thomas Aquinas and John Calvin, or I should say the Augustinian church. We're going to contrast Thomas Aquinas and John Calvin. In the modern church, we're going to contrast B.B. Warfield and Abraham Kuyper, and then come to a conclusion in the work and labors of Cornelius Van Til. I think this does provide at least a good way of hitting the mountain peaks of church history. I will have to have you read some parts of these lectures that are maybe more background and introductory material on philosophy, and if that completely snows you, you can ask me some questions about it, but I don't promise I'll be able to answer them all. All right? So we come then to Section 1, the Early Church, Justin Martyr and Tertullian, or we might entitle it Greek Philosophy and Christian Apologetics. I want to say something, first of all, about the intellectual setting of the early church by way of introduction. It's impossible to avoid some reference to Greek philosophy and an historical introduction to apologetics. Impossible. If Christian apologetics is the vindication of the Christian philosophy of life against the various forms of non-Christian philosophies of life, then one will have to understand those philosophies in order to assess the value of any apologetic. The history of Greek philosophy can be divided into three fairly well-marked epochs. There's the pre-Socratic era, 585 B.C. to 399 B.C. There's the era of Plato and Aristotle, 385 B.C. to 323 B.C. And there's the Hellenistic Age, 300 B.C. to about A.D. 529, when I think Justinian closed the last school of Greek philosophy. That, by the way, comes basically, that outline from Gordon H. Clark's Tales de Dewey. It is, of course, the so-called Hellenistic Age which interests us. In the Hellenistic Age, there are three major philosophies: Epicureanism, Platonism, and Stoicism. Our interest is mainly in the latter two philosophies. Kelly remarks, both the Stoicism and, to an even greater extent, the Platonism, which flourished in the first two Christian centuries, had borrowed from the other, and indeed the intellectual attitude of great numbers of educated people might be described as either a Platonizing Stoicism or a Stoicizing Platonism. Our interest in Greek philosophy is, however, not finally in the details of any one of its manifestations, but rather in the general views which it held. Now, several of its general characteristics must now be mentioned. I've done my best under five basic headings to summarize for you the basic contours of Greek philosophy. And of necessity, there's a great deal of simplification going on here, but I do believe that, at least substantially, there may be a little caricaturing unbeknownst to myself, but substantially I'm going to be giving you the overriding thoughts and characteristics of Greek philosophy. And I've got to do this if you're going to understand what we're going to be coming to, especially in this first section. Now, first of all, I want to say that there is a tendency in Greek thought to adopt a monistic view of being. What do I mean by monistic? Well, I mean that the Greek philosophers assumed that there was only one kind of being. Do you believe there's only one kind of being? Anything that existed was being. Being was therefore one, and it was without origin. So there's the first assumption. Anything that exists is being, and being, by definition, is one. Now, the second thing you have to understand now becomes a little bit hard to grasp, I acknowledge, but there's a tendency that we view the world as intention or balance. Here, I'm going to want to move this over here a little bit because I need all this back for it. The world is intention between being and non-being. Well, what is non-being? Well, non-being is nothing. But not exactly. It's not exactly nothing, because the world is made up of non-being and being, and therein lies the problem. What does that mean, that you have a tension between being and non-being? Well, heaven or the world of spirit, being / spirit, heaven or the world of spirit above was viewed as real, possessing true being. Matter the stuff out of which the material world we live in was made is viewed as non-being. Now that's a completely reverse way of looking at reality for modern life, isn't it? Because for the modern man, typical modern man, the reality is what's material, and the irreality, the unreality, is anything that has to do with spirit. But it was basically the complete opposite for the Greek thinker. The spiritual world was characterized by a basic oneness or ultimate unity. Being was basically one. Matter, on the other hand, was endlessly different. It was therefore characterized by complete diversity. It was therefore impossible to see any harmony or unifying themes in it. It was meaningless. Now, you have to understand, the whole matter of theories of knowledge. You understand that the way we think is to put individual items into categories. Categorization is the way we think. And that means you're always thinking in terms of universals and particulars. All those books on the shelves over there fit into one category of book, don't they? And then we could subdivide. The way we would begin to know those books is we'd begin to subdivide them into different categories. You'd be basically again and again and again and again dealing with the whole subject of the one and the many, or what can otherwise be called universals and particulars. Not only that, we have another set of particulars making up a universal in this room. You have seven human beings in this room. We are seven particular human beings, but we all are a member of the category of human being. See, again, when you begin to think, it's a matter of analysis, it's a matter of understanding universals and particulars and the way they relate to one another. Now, for the group, you see, the being, because it was ultimately one, had a category about it. But this non-being stuff down here was endlessly different. It was just one stray piece of matter, atom after another. And as long as there was simply endless diversity, you couldn't know it because there were no categories to it. There were no themes. There were no universals. And so it couldn't exist. How can you know something? How can something exist that you can't know? If you can't know it, it must not exist. That's at least one of the implications of the whole matter, of it being matter. It's endless diversity. It has no unity about it, simply endless diversity. So long as it remains sheer matter, non-being, or flesh, it has no significance and therefore has no being. It's impossible to see any harmony in it, any unifying themes in it, and because that you can't get any universals out of it or fit it into any categories, it's meaningless. And therefore, for all intents and purposes, it doesn't exist. But third, now there is a tendency among the Greek philosophers to achieve meaning in this world. You notice where we got the world here? In between being and non-being. With contributions being made from both sides. There's a tendency among the Greek philosophers to achieve meaning in this world in tension between being and non-being, spirit and matter, reason and meaninglessness, by means of the Logos. The Logos, who is viewed as a mediator between being, supreme being, and the world. The Logos principle, called the Logos, because by definition Logos is reason. The Logos principle unfolds and applies the principle of being, unity, and reason. It applies that whole thing to matter or non-being. The principle of meaninglessness, change, and diversity. Thus, by imposing order, form, and reason on matter, the Logos makes the world as we know it. Why do we find any reason in this chaotic world of ours? Because at least parts of it still bear the forms and shapes that were imposed upon it by the Logos. Why does matter now have rationality about it? Why does it fit into categories? Why are the universals in it? Because the Logos principle, at the beginning, imposed these forms upon the world. Some of them would go on to say that these forms in the world reflect things in the heavenly world dimly. All right? But anyway, we don't need to confuse you with that. Logos mediates the reason of the Supreme Being to the meaninglessness of matter, so creating the world as we know it. Thus, by imposing order, form, and reason on matter, the Logos makes the world as we know it. The Logos principle mediates being, unity, and rationality into the meaninglessness, diversity, and constant change of matter. Thus, the Logos principle brings about the world as we know it, in which exist both universals and particulars. Fourth. Now, there is a tendency also in Greek philosophy to identify human reason with the Logos principle. In other words, just as the Logos gives reason, form, and unity to the material world, so there is what they call the logoi, spermatikoi, Greek scholars know what that means? What are the logoi, spermatikoi? The spiritual seeds. The reasonable seeds. All right? Now, the point is that human beings are just a microcosm of the world. The Logos gives order, form, and reason to the material world. So also do these little sparks of divine fire that have been sowed or seeded into the minds of men, these little sparks of Logoi, of reason, logos, have been sown into the minds of men, so that each man is a microcosm of the world. He has a body, that's the non-being, immaterial, fleshly principle, enlivened, given reason and intelligence by a little spark or seed of the, somewhat at least, divine logos. Right? So that there is this inseparable connection between human reason and super being and the principle, the divine principle, if you will, of reason. And therefore, of course, there is a tendency to deify, in the most literal use of those words, human reason. Human reason is the representative of the being, spirit, and rationality in the world. Now, fifthly, everything that has been said under the first four points leads to the conclusion that in all of Greek philosophy there is no doctrine of creation. Not in the Christian sense, anyhow. God is a nameless and indescribable principle of being and rationality. The Logos principle emanates from him and mediates rationality to the world. But the world is simply a combination of the eternal principles of being and non-being. Being and non-being, rationality and irrationality, spirit and matter are thought of as equally eternal principles existing in everlasting contradiction and interaction. Now, what I've just said means that no matter how fine-sounding any particular statement of a Greek philosopher may be, every last statement that any Greek philosopher makes must ultimately be judged as completely heretical. Because the entire Christian system is founded on a completely different structural view of the universe than this one. The Christian does not believe in one kind of being. He is committed by the very foundations of his system to believe in two kinds of being. He's committed to believing in a creator and a creature. He is committed to believing in the creator-creature distinction. And without that distinction assumed and presupposed, nothing anyone says is the least bit Christian. It's rather anti-Christian in the most basic sense of the word. So you see, you have a view of the universe that implies two equal and ultimate eternal principles, a world, and man that's completely opposed in every last manifestation of it, fundamentally to basic Christian perception. The Greek philosopher believes that all reason is one and the same. Divine reason, human reason, ultimately one. Human reason, therefore, divine. That all matter is basically one, that there is non-being, and that non-being is basically evil and material, you see. And so, that's fundamentally at odds with the Christian who believes that there is such a thing as divine and infinite reason, and such a thing as human reason, and the two are not the same kind of being. Any questions? You're going to begin to see the significance of those observations, I trust, as we come to look at Justin Martyr. Does that make enough sense to you to ask any questions about it? Yes, Bob? He opposes the principles of unity in his own mind upon the diversity of the world. And that the unity isn't in the world, it's in his mind. There is a contrast between Kant, because he basically has to bring in the noumenal world, the things in themselves, as a kind of presupposition for human existence. But what you really know rationally, or practically at least, and can work with is the world, the phenomenal world, not the noumenal world. The noumenal world exists purely as a presupposition to make sense of human experience, or parts of human experience that can't be made sense of on the basis of practical reason. And the categories of your mind and the way they impose unity on the world in front of you. Yeah, I'll talk about Kant when we come there. You bring up an interesting point, though. Let me put it this way. Yeah, the Greeks did stress that all reason and understanding, rationality, came from the unifying concept of being. But you see, the problem, and I'm not sure if they ever learned this lesson, the problem with saying that is to say you've got to have the unifying principle to turn into rationality this whole endless diversity of the non-being material world. The problem with saying that is that if you have simply unifying categories without any particulars, you don't have rationality either. You don't have rationality if you have the one. In fact, that actually happened. One of the things that became a tendency in the early Christian theologians who were being affected by Greek philosophy is they began to say that God was nameless. Why did they have to say that God was nameless? Well, because all you can say about being is that it's one. And the supreme being is beyond reason. Here, in fact, this began to become clear. You couldn't really know being in itself. In Neoplatonism, ultimately, you could know the logos as the principle of reason. But if you're ever going to, and you can know that by speculation, by doing philosophy, but if you're ever going to know being itself, you had to enter into a mystic trance, because being as one is beyond and above reason. You can't know something that's just one, and you can't know anything else about it. It's just one. It's just like some form of Eastern mysticism. How do you know one? It's just one. You know, it's one, and that's all you can say about it. It's just one, and it just kind of frustrates any thinking. You see, one of the problems here is that they thought rationality dwelt up here, and this was irrationality. The problem is that you don't have rationality at all unless you have both universals and particulars. And so what you have in the Christian system, this is one place I can say this, I don't think you get a chance to say it, is that the Creator is rational, because in the existence of the Creator, you have the universal and the particulars. What am I talking about when I say that? The Trinity. The universal, he's one. The particulars, he's Father, Son, and Spirit. We can know the Creator because you have this, you have universals and particulars in uncreated being. But then God has created universals that bind the world together. You see, so that down here you also have universals and particulars, because God has created harmonizing themes in the world. But now you see, the problem, and this is what Van Til means sometimes when he speaks this way, is that the Greek kind of God doesn't have rationality because he's the universal and the world is the particular. So for God to be known, he needs the world. He unfolds himself in the world. And so here you have one and many down here. So that God is in some sense dependent upon the world for rationality, to unfold himself. Well, that's where Van Til's going to say, no. God is self-sufficient. He doesn't need the world for anything. He was rational without the world. There were universals and particulars. There was a universal and particulars in God himself without the world. The world is simply a copy of that universal particular character of God and the rationality of that kind of God, because God has created finite, creaturely universals, binding together finite, creaturely universal particulars. I hope that's making some kind of sense to you, but that's one of the ways in which the Christian doctrine of the Trinity is at the bottom of any sound epistemology, because it shows us that in uncreated being and created being, you need universal and particulars, and there's that theme both in the creator and in the creature. Come on. Yeah, well, I think that their lack of a doctrine of creation has a moral and ethical basis, but I think that it's consistent with their view anyway, I would say. Mm-hmm.
And then also, I was just wondering, maybe this is getting off the point, but when the Buddha speaks of nothingness returning to nothingness, is there any relationship there too to their, to them having an idea in their worldview of one of the many, the ultimate being by itself, when you're absorbed as a particular into that?
Yeah, there's a great deal of similarity to Neoplatonism. I mean, when they start talking about trying to visualize the sound of one hand clapping, or something like that, I forget what the exact is. I mean, that, and if that's what you do to get yourself ready to become one with the ultimate being. But that's just to say that ultimate reality is irrational. It can't be rationally understood, which is again where Greek Neoplatonism ended up with it, was the final step in the whole process. Okay, let's go to Justin Martyr. You may be able to see some of the significance of this more plainly. First of all, significance. The difference of opinion among Christians as to how to defend the Christian faith emerges with the first Christian theologians who ever set out formally to present and defend Christianity to the surrounding world. Van Til designates the period of the Apologist, the first major combat between the Christian and Greek paideia. Paideia means system of instruction. These early defenders of Christianity were called the Apologists. These Christians lived in the 2nd century, about 100 years after the Apostles, around 150 to 200 AD. They wrote, in order to defend Christians and present Christianity to the Romans and Greeks. Thus, they were very concerned that Christianity should appear reasonable to the world dominated at that time by Greek philosophy. Natural enough, you might think. What's his background? The most famous of these apologists was Justin, called Martyr. He lived approximately AD 110 to 165. One writer makes these very significant remarks about the background and conversion of Justin. Justin was a Gentile, but born in Samaria near Jacob's well. He must have been well educated. He had traveled extensively, and he seems to have been a person enjoying a competence. In other words, he didn't have to work for a living. After trying all other systems, his elevated taste and refined perceptions made him a disciple of Socrates and Plato. So he climbed toward Christ, as he himself narrates the story of his conversion in his dialogue with Crippo the Jew. It need not be anticipated here. What Plato was feeling after, he found in Jesus of Nazareth. What Plato was feeling after, Justin found in Jesus of Nazareth. The conversion of such a man marks a new era in the gospel history. The sub-apostolic age begins with the first Christian author, the founder of theological literature. It introduced to mankind, as the mother of true philosophy, the spies' teaching of those Galileans to whom their master had said, "Ye are the light of the world." You had a new epoch in Christianity when a philosopher was converted to Christ. Well, that's his background. What's his apologetic? By the way, I should say he did die as a martyr. That's why he's called Justin Martyr. Well, his apologetic, first something about its character. It's not surprising that Justin, with this background, used ideas popularized in Greek philosophy to present Christianity to the secular world. As we have seen, Greek philosophy had developed a vague idea of a supreme being at this time, who by means of his logos or reason gave order, life, and reason to the world of matter. Thus the logos, which emanated from the supreme being, mediated between the supreme being and the world of matter. Human beings were reasonable creatures endowed with free will because in reality a little spark of this divine logos or reason dwelt in them. So you had the doctrines of human mind, human will, all of them related to this logos doctrine. Now, Justin Martyr adapted these ideas to Christianity and used them as means to communicate the gospel to the heathen. It was easy to identify the Greek supreme being with God the Father, and the Logos with the Son, or Word, Logos, John 1:1, of God. The Christian idea of being made in the image of God and possessed of freedom and reason as made in the image of God was identified with the Greek idea of men as inhabited by a spark of the divine fire. The main writings of Justin Martyr in which he presented his views are his first and second apologies directed toward the Gentiles and his dialogue with Crypho the Jew. Obviously directed towards Israel, and they'll be cited below. So that's the character of his apologetic. I want to see its advantages. Of course, there were a number of advantages to Justin's method. No doubt, he made Christianity appear more intellectually respectable to the Greek world. It also helped make the Christian doctrine of the Trinity seem less contradictory to the Greeks. How can you Christians say there's one God and then say the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit are all God? That doesn't make any sense, the Greek would have said. Well, Justin said, just look at this. You see, you've got the supreme being and you've got the Logos. That's what we got. He's got the Spirit there too, but we don't talk about that too much. No problem. Why do you guys have a problem with the Christian doctrine of the Trinity? Also, Justin's identification of Jesus Christ with the Greek Logos helped explain the measure of virtue and knowledge to be found in Greek culture and philosophy. Well, you see, If Jesus Christ was the Logos, and he had given little sparks of truth to these Greek philosophers, then we can explain why there's virtue and knowledge in Greek culture and philosophy. What's the problem with all this? Well, the problem with Justin's apologetic was that it assumed a very favorable view of Greek philosophy and its relation to Christianity. Justin's view was that Greek philosophy was inspired by the same Logos who became incarnate in Christ. What the Greeks had partially, infallibly in the Greek philosophers, that the Christians have completely and infallibly in Christ. Now, this quite positive evaluation of Greek philosophy is stated in his second apology. He says, I confess that I both boasted with all my strength, tried to be found a Christian. Not because the teachings of Plato are different from those of Christ, but because they're not in all respects similar. You see that, what he's saying? Not different, but they're not in all respects similar either. As neither are those of the other Stoics and poets and historians. For each man spoke well in proportion to the share he had of the spermatic word, logoi, spermatikoi, seeing what was related to it. For next to God, we worship and love the word, logos, who is from the unbegotten and ineffable, the word ineffable means indescribable, God. See how Greek thinking is beginning to affect his view of God? You can't describe God. Is that a Christian idea? No, it's not a Christian idea. The idea that God is indescribable is a Greek idea. But now it's being confused with God's incomprehensibility. Since also he became man for our sakes. For all the writers were able to see realities darkly through the sowing of the implanted word that was in them. For the seed, an imitation imparted according to capacity, is one thing. Quite another is the thing itself, of which there is the participation and imitation according to the grace which is from him. So you had Socrates and Plato over here. Okay? Now these guys said some good things, says Justin. How in the world did they say some good things if they weren't Christians? Well, It's because, you see, the Logos had given them little sparks of truth, little seeds of truth. He's sowing among them. Now, granted, it was partial truth, and it was fallible truth. It was neither complete nor infallible. But you see, the advantage of Christianity is not that it's completely different from this, but that that the Logos became incarnate in Jesus Christ. All right? Now, so you see, therefore, though they had partiable, fallible truth, Christianity has the advantage because it's complete. The Logos himself becomes incarnate. He just doesn't give little seeds of truth. And it's infallible now. So here's the difference between Greek philosophy and Christianity. Now, even some respected Reformed theologians have shared just and somewhat positive view of Greek philosophy. W.G.T. Shedd represents many defenders of the Christian faith who respond positively to Justin's evaluation of Greek philosophy. He applauds Justin because, quoting, he perceives that a system of philosophy like the Platonic is favorable to the principles of ethics and natural religion, and therefore insists, and with right, that so far as it can properly go, it's not unfriendly to the system of revealed truth. There's a certain friendship that we can have with these Greek philosophers. Shedd thought that it was very wise to take over what he called Greek theism and use it in the defense of Christianity. The perspective of Shedd and Justin Martyr is simply that Platonism is right as far as it goes, but it doesn't go far enough. Well, that's going to be an interesting thing to evaluate biblically. Is that a right kind of view of Greek philosophy and other religions? If they're right and good as far as they go, they just don't go far enough? What does the Bible say about that? Well, come forthly with me to the disadvantages of Justin's apologetic. The disadvantages of Justin's defense of the faith are related to his favorable view of Greek philosophy. It seems clear that he was insensitive to or ignorant of the basic contradictions between Christianity and Greek philosophy. The result of ignoring these contradictions would be to misrepresent or pervert the Christian faith, even in his attempt, within his very attempt to defend it and commend it to others. But the evidence for Justin's ignorance of the contradictions between Christianity and Greek philosophy follows. First, Justin appeals to heathen analogies to the miraculous history of Christ. He refers to the stories of the Greek myths, which speak of terrible sufferings and marvelous ascensions to heaven of the sons of Jupiter. I heard this nut on the radio the other night who was talking about the fact that there were 42 crucified saviors before Jesus Christ. I don't know what he was referring to, but he may have been referring to this. He was the offspring of some Unitarians. Interesting. In some regards as blasphemous in others, but he then remarks that Christians teach, now notice what Justin said, nothing different from what you believe regarding those whom you esteem sons of Jupiter. Nothing different. Nothing different. What do you mean nothing different, Justin? Thus Justin can say, though we say things similar to what the Greeks say, we only are hated on account of the name of Christ. But Justin's argument may be intended simply to point out that the Greeks taught things similar to what Christians teach, so why do they persecute Christians? It is injustice, therefore, if Greeks persecute Christians while they themselves teach similar things. Nevertheless, the question must be asked, does not Justin speak in a very unguarded fashion when he says that Christian doctrine is nothing different and similar to heathen teachings? Is he not endangering the uniqueness of Christianity? The first problem. Second, what Justin teaches about the freedom of the human will is not Christian. First Apology, paragraphs 43 and 61. Second Apology, paragraph 7. The occasion for Justin's statements upon this subject is quite interesting. In the midst of arguing for the claims of Christ on the basis of fulfilled prophecy, Justin realizes that his claims may be seen as implying, because if you've got prophecy, of course, something must have been certain beforehand. Because you can't have prophecy unless something is certain from beforehand, right? You can't prophesy something that's not certain. Now, Justin was a good enough philosopher to realize that. So he has himself a problem now. Justin realizes that his claims about fulfilled prophecy may be seen as implying that whatever happens, happens by fatal necessity. Well, there you got a problem. You have fatal necessity. What happens to free will? Well, in this paragraph, Justin therefore proceeds to argue as follows. We have learned from the prophets, and we hold it to be true, that punishments and chastisements and good rewards are rendered according to the merit of each man's actions. Since if it be not so, but all things happen by fate, neither is anything at all in our power. For if it be fated that this man, e.g., be good, and this other evil, neither is the former meritorious, nor the latter to be blamed. And again, unless the human race have the power of avoiding evil and choosing good by free choice, that's in theological terminology, is known as the power of contrary choice, which is exactly the view of free will held by Arminians. And again, unless the human race have the power of avoiding evil and choosing good by free choice, they're not accountable for their actions of whatever kind they be. So, Justin says, now, I don't want you to misunderstand me. Though we've got prophecy here somehow or other, I don't want you to think that that means that people aren't free. No, they have free wills. They can merit some things or demerit others, and that has to be the case if there's going to be any moral order in the world. When you see how far he's departing from Christianity and the Christian doctrine of free will and grace and a number of other things? And why is he doing all that? Well, because, you see, he's got a view of free will that is Greek. Justin can also speak of the one who chooses to be born again in the waters of baptism. Apology 1, paragraph 61. In his second apology, Justin returns to this theme in even more clear language. The Stoics, not observing this, maintain that all things take place according to the necessity of fate. But since God in the beginning made the race of angels and men with free will, they will justly suffer in eternal fire the punishment of whatever sins they committed. And this is the nature of all that is made to be capable of vice and virtue, for neither would any of them be praiseworthy unless there were power to turn to both. Again, that's a very blatant and what would later be known as a semi-Pelagian or Arminian or Pelagian view of free will. Now, we must not overreact to these statements. It's true that Christianity is not fatalism. It maintains the serious moral responsibility and freedom of men. And due both to Stoicism and Gnosticism, there was a fatalistic tendency in Justin's day which did not do justice to human responsibility and freedom. That's true. So Justin may be reacting against that tendency, overreacting. Yet one must still ask, has Justin been pushed into a view of human freedom which is imbalanced? He never does explain how prophecy and foreknowledge are consistent with his view of human freedom. Is there not perhaps here a naive adoption of a Platonic view of human freedom? This question appears to be answered with a yes when in the paragraph following his initial assertion of free will, we hear Justin saying, and so too Plato, when he says, the blame is his who chooses, and God is blameless. So now he quotes Plato in support of his doctrine of free will. How interesting. Third, Justin adopts the Greek idea that the supreme being is nameless. For no one, he says, can utter the name of the ineffable God, and if anyone dared to say that there is a name, he raised with hopeless madness. Why then does the Bible give God so many names? But to the Father of all who was unbegotten, there is no name given, he says. Justin misunderstands the incomprehensibility of God to mean the namelessness of God. Again, the influence of Greek philosophy with this idea of the supreme being as an indescribable abstract principle of reality, of rationality, and being has influenced Justin. Fourth, more justification for our concerns about Justin's positive view of Greek philosophy becomes evident when he says that he, Christ, is the Word of whom every race of men were partakers. Every race of men were partakers, not just the Jews. And those who lived reasonably are Christians, even though they have been thought atheists, as among the Greeks, Socrates and Heraclitus, and men like them. Justin's thinking of the operations of reason, the logos, in nature. Therefore, in these statements of Justin, there is clear confirmation of our fears. Justin plainly departs from the Christian faith by teaching the salvation of the Greek philosophers purely through their obedience to natural revelation, as we would say, Greek philosophy. Clearly, Justin has purchased the advantages of his defense of the faith only at a great cost to the Christian faith itself. Van Til's assessment is penetrating. He says that because Justin lived early in church history, he had some excuse for not being aware of the dangers of using Greek philosophy to defend Christianity. That's true, he had some excuse. Yet he points out that Christians must not be deceived into thinking that high and noble forms of non-Christian philosophy are not filled with dangers for the Christian faith. The dilemma which Justin Martyr faced and failed to solve continues to be important for Christians in their apologetics. How do we explain the good in the world without denying the unique truth of Christianity? Here we have over in the world, there are people who seem good. They have some truth. They seem to understand some things. They seem to be of cultures that have a lot that's admirable about them. How do we explain all of that consistent with the uniqueness of Christianity? The fact that Christianity claims to have truth. How do we explain all of that? How do we recognize the goodness in the world without being tempted to join with it? Those are legitimate questions and problems that would have to be dealt with and answered in some other way than Plato did. But now we come to Catullus. And I'll hasten right on, and you can ask questions when we're done. Catullus, the contrasting figure. First of all, A, his general significance. Catullus was a Christian pastor who worked and wrote around the years 200 to 225, shortly after Justin. He's known as an anti-Gnostic father. Gnosticism, the most dangerous of the early heresies to assault the church, stressed the absolute contrast between the world of spirit and the world of flesh. Sounds like Greek philosophy, doesn't it? One of his primary heresies was, therefore, that the earthly Jesus and the divine Christ were two different beings. Thus, they were docetist, from the Greek word dokeo, meaning to think or to seem. Thus, they were docetist, those who taught that the Christ only seemed to be a man. Since he was struggling with this heresy, which had deep roots in Greek thinking, Tertullian manifested more awareness of the danger of Greek and worldly philosophy than Justin did, because he was trying to refute a very grievous form of it. The different perspective enunciated by Tertullian may be seen in Gordon H. Clark's pithy summary of Tertullian. Whereas, says Clark, Justin had spoken appreciatively of the pagan literature, Tertullian is best known for his harsh condemnation of it. Skilled in the rhetoric of the law schools, he declaims, what is the Christian in common with the philosopher? Jerusalem with Athens, the church with the academy, revelation with reason. And to illustrate his contempt for all heathen rationality, modern authors sometimes quote him as accepting the gospel in the words, credo quia absurdum, I believe, because it is absurd. Now, there's no evidence, says Clark, that Tertullian used that particular phrase, although he did say, sepultus resurrexit, surtum est quia impulsibly est, or how he said the Latin there, which means something like, I am confident of the resurrection. It is certain because it is impossible. Did you have Latin, Stephen? Is that a fairly safe rendition of it? Okay. I'm glad there's no here. One here can correct me then. Because I'm certain my Latin can be grievously corrected. Well, anyway, you see Tertullian's statement. And why does he say, I am confident of the resurrection is certain because it is impossible? Is he really buying into irrationality? No, he's saying, look, it doesn't matter to me what these reasoners of Greek philosophy say. What their philosophy says is not important to me. Even if it seems impossible on the grounds of Greek philosophy, I'll believe it for that very reason. You know, sometimes we say, if Dan Rather said it, that's good enough reason not to believe it. I think that's what Tertullian was saying. The Greek philosophers said it, that's good enough reason to disagree with it. I'm confident of the resurrection. I'm confident because the Greek philosophers don't believe in it. So he says, I'm confident of the resurrection. It's certain because it's impossible. Dan Rather says it's impossible, then it must be certain. Well, that's his general significance. And then we come to his specific importance. because of this attitude about philosophy, Tertullian emphasized the importance of simple faith in the Scriptures, lo and behold, as the final authority. Listen to what he says. After Jesus Christ, we have no need of speculation. After the gospel, no need of research. When we come to believe, we have no desire to believe anything else. For we begin by believing that there's nothing else that we have to believe. Did you understand what he just said? We begin by believing that there's nothing else which we have to believe. My first principle is this. Christ laid down one definite system of truth which the world must believe without qualification, and which we must seek precisely in order to believe it when we find it. What you must seek is what Christ has taught, and precisely as long as you are not finding, precisely until then you must go on seeking until you do find it. What's he saying? He's saying we must not be like those people mentioned in the New Testament that are always learning and never able to come to the knowledge of the truth. There's no virtue in seeking truth. There's only virtue in holding on to it once you find it. There's some academicians who want to be eternally seeking truth. And there's like anything, that's nonsense. And Christ has given us the truth, and the only virtue in seeking truth is to seek it until you find it. Once you got it, you forget everything else. And so there's a movement in those words to some sort of recognition of the final authority of the Scriptures. And a rejection of philosophical speculation after you have the truth. Well, what's his remaining weakness? Greek philosophy sneaked into Tertullian's thought, too. He wasn't as good as the isolated quotations I've given you might make him seem. Specifically, his teaching about the Trinity and the soul were deeply influenced by a Stoic form of Greek philosophy. Even here, however, Tertullian's teaching was increasingly biblical and tended more and more to contradict and violate the very Stoic philosophy he used to present as Christian teaching. And Warfield documents that, by the way, in a beautiful way in his article on Tertullian in his collected writings for his complete work. Anyway, it's obvious, therefore, that the emphasis of Tertullian is on the gall that separates Christ and Plato and the need for forsaking philosophy in order to believe the Scriptures. That seems to be the general drift of where he's going. And you see the contrast then between Tertullian and Justin. What's our assessment? Well, I want to say one, two, three things, and then I'll be done. A, the general concern. Justin's apologetics had a subtle but powerful tendency to distort Christianity. The advantages of Justin's adaptation of Greek philosophy to the Christian cause carried with us some very great disadvantages. The basic problem was that in adapting Greek philosophy to Christianity, there was a subtle but powerful tendency to adapt Christianity to Greek philosophy. And he's not the last one to have that problem among apologists. The problem with Justin's methodology is that it assumes that the Greek concept of God, the Logos, human reason, and human freedom are, for all intents and purposes, practically the same as that of Christianity. It assumes that one can use Greek philosophy to present Christianity without changing the meaning of Christianity in the process. And we must ask, is human reason and human freedom the same thing when it is viewed as a spark of divine fire inhabiting a material body as when it's viewed as a part of the image of God? Are those the same things, really? That's the general concern. But then the fundamental difference. The fundamental difference is that the Greek and Christian concepts of God are in basic contradiction. Even more basic is the difference between the Greek and Christian concept of God revealed in Plato's Socratic dialogue entitled the Euthyphro. Euthyphro. Gordon H. Clark describes it. In the dialogue, Euthyphro, the question is raised whether pious acts are pious because the gods like them, or whether the gods like them because the acts are pious. Now, I hope it's not too late at night for you to read it on that one. What was the question? Well, it's an abiding question, though. Why are things good? Are they good because the gods like them, or do the gods like them because they're good? What's the basic issue at stake there? What's the basic issue at stake? Well, you see, the basic issue is whether God is the ultimate standard of good. Or is there a standard that is above the gods to which they themselves have to conform? Think about that question in Christian terms. Are things good and just because God likes them? Or does God like them because they are good and just? Well, the answer is, of course, that God himself is the ultimate standard of right and wrong. You see, here's the question. Is it this or this? Be careful. If you answer, well, God likes them because they're good, then I want to know how you avoid saying that there's some standard above, there's something more ultimate than God himself. No, obviously the Christian answer is this. God is good, and therefore things are good because God likes them. God himself is the ultimate standard of right and wrong, and that things are good and just simply because he esteems them to be so. Otherwise, you have a standard of right and wrong above God and to which he must subject himself. But what's interesting here is that that's not the view which Plato adopts. Clark says, he knows the logical possibility, by this, he knows the logical possibility that pious acts are good because God likes them. But instead of arguing against such a view, he merely brushes it aside as unworthy of consideration. To his thoroughly Greek mind, it seems obviously absurd. It's obvious that the gods like things because there's this standard of good. That's clear to me, he said. Didn't have to argue the other option, even though it's abstractly possible. But if the gods like pious acts because the acts are pious, it follows that there's a standard, a norm, or a quality of piety superior to the will of the gods. The existence of such a standard independent of the will of the gods is, of course, consonant with Greek presupposition. Ventil's comment on the Euthyphro is trenchant. Here, then, is a complete disjunction or contrast. On the one side, we have God as the sovereign lawgiver. On the other side, we have an abstract and personal law that is assumed to be independent and therefore above any lawgiver. When Socrates demanded that deeds be holy irrespective of what gods or men say about them, he was deceiving himself. What he really wanted was a concept of the holy that he, independently of God, could understand and approve. So if there's a concept of good that we can understand apart from God and above God, then we can do what? We can call God himself into judgment to our understanding of good. And so Van Til is right when he goes on to say, what he really wanted was a concept of the holy that he, independently of God, could understand and approve. It was his own concept of justice that he set over against the concept of justice as given by any such being as the Creator, Redeemer of men. The disjunctions between the God of Christianity and the idea of the self-sufficient man. See, here we come back to the whole idea of the self-sufficiency of man or the self-sufficiency of God. And of course, the whole idea of the sovereignty of God is that he is self-sufficient. He has no need of a standard outside himself. He is the ultimate standard. But see, we come to the twisted results. Just to say here that Justin's apologetic bore terrible fruit in the end. It's obvious that a Christianity clothed in Greek philosophy will subtly but powerfully deviate from the Bible. This is very evident in Justin's assessment of the spiritual condition of the Greek philosophers. He is the word of whom every race of men were partakers, and those who lived reasonably are Christians, even though they have been thought atheists, as among the Greeks, Socrates and Heraclitus and men like them. By this statement, Justin is logically denied that the gospel is necessary for men to be saved and has saving light, and has attributed, I want to say, saving light to the operations of the Logos among the Greek philosophers. even more serious errors would proceed from the adaptation of Christianity to Greek philosophy. Some of Justin's spiritual descendants would become the Arian heretics of the 4th century and deny the deity of Christ and the doctrine of the Trinity. These facts should make us wary of building a defense of Christianity on the foundation of non-Christian philosophy. Christianity built on the foundation of Greek philosophy tends to cease being Christianity. We come down on the side of Tertullian when he asks, what is the Christian in common with the philosopher? Jerusalem with Athens, the church with the academy, revelation with reason. Nevertheless, if we agree with Tertullian, we must still ask, what about the apparent morality, wisdom, knowledge of God, and success of non-Christian cultures? How can this be explained if Christ is the sole source of truth and light? Another question raised here is this, if the Christian has nothing in common with the Greek philosopher, how shall we defend the faith through him? Is there no common ground or point of contact between the believer and the unbeliever? You see, Justin had common ground, didn't he? The Greek philosophers had partially infallibly, but the Christians had infallibly and wholly. There's common ground. We're saying he was wrong to have that kind of common ground. Well, if that's the wrong kind of common ground, what is there? What is the point of contact? What is the common ground? If there is common ground, what is it? Well, that's a question for further discussion. Any questions? Yes, Bob.
With this same idea here of the Greek philosophy trying to understand concepts apart from God, like good, abstract, things above God, also applies in the desire of some evangelicals and others to use reason as an abstract concept above God, that is, to understand it intelligibly apart from God.
Absolutely, because that's in principle what's going on. If you attempt to have reason and use anything to argue your way from neutrality to God, you by definition have an abstract principle that apparently you can understand apart from God himself. But that's simply to deny the self-sufficiency of God and the sovereignty of God. You follow what he's saying? If you have any principle that you can use apart from the presupposition of God's existence, in order to prove God's existence and bring the fact of the existence of God from the realm of doubt to the realm of certainty, then you have abstract principles that are not under the control of and rooted in the being of God himself. Same thing. Yeah, same thing in principle, in my opinion. A little subtler kind of way of doing it, but the same thing, I think. And so that's why any kind of apologetics or evidentialism which attempts to do that very subtly has at its heart a denial of some basic realities about the existence of God and the nature of Christianity. There's nothing that doesn't assume and imply the existence of God. If there is, then you've just by admitting it denied logically and implicitly the existence of the Christian God. And you'll never prove the existence of the Christian God by starting out by assuming that he doesn't exist, which is what you do when you have any abstract principle that has meaning apart from the existence of God. Yeah, amen. That's exactly right. Go ahead.
You know, I was thinking about this the other day, too. A person, I think, could use a syllogism that everything... all things, God is necessary for the intelligibility of all things. Reason is one of those all things, therefore God is necessary for the intelligibility of reason. Somebody denies the major premise and they deny Christianity, if they try to prove the major premise, they have to presuppose God, because even if they try to prove it by their reason, then they proved it as being true, and therefore they acknowledge that.
Well, yeah, but, you could put it this way too. If you try to prove the major premise, you've just denied it, right?
If you try to prove it, you either have to prove it on the grounds of what the syllogism states to prove it, or if you try to say that you're going to prove it by reason, you're denying it. But even if you subtly think that you have proved it your whole purpose for proving it is self-destructive. I mean, you're destroying your whole philosophy by trying to...
What would your purpose to prove? What would your evidence to prove that? You have a conclusion?
God is my evidence. What God has revealed.
Well, you reveal, that's evidence, but it's not that.
No, it's not.
Sure, if you're looking out, you've drawn conclusions to your
faith. He's spoken to me through it.
So your experience is the evidence.
Well,
that's evidence is true.
That's right. It's evidence is God has told me.
So you made your premises, but not evidence.
But see, none of my evidence is understood apart from God.
So before you had your evidence, you God.
All of my evidence is I understand through faith. Yes.
After they occurred to you.
They are evidences which are evidences which all point to God or are intelligible by pausing and considering them.
So there's a reason.
Right. And that reason is not reason in the abstract, but that reason is God's
rationale.
Its logical priority has nothing to do with it.
Yes, it does, though, because we all exist. We have to make our next thought based on where we stand right now, believer and non-believer, so that you can never make your next thought based upon conclusions drawn from a following piece of evidence or a following point, which is appears to me to be what you're doing when you, if you have no reason to state the major premise without first having an evidence.
Well, now, I'm not exactly sure where you're going with that, but my understanding of what you're saying is that the fact that I breathe, the fact that I exist, are you saying that we should start off with man's existence as being, that man's autonomy as being...
Well, I would say that it seems that you can start nowhere else but as an existing Christian. I mean, how else can you start? The first moment you say one word or think one thought, you've actually just lived out your existence until
right.
You started it. You can't
as a created being of God.
Yeah, as a created being. So
see, but I don't understand my existence in the abstract, but I always understand.
No, but you live it. You just start from nothing. In other words, you don't start and make one move or one thought already understanding the whole of Christian
theology. But that sounds like you're just going back into abstract into nothing.
No.
Meaningless.
Maybe it's confessing that you can't start anywhere else but as an existent person.
That's just a being.
Sure, whatever.
It has no meaning except that.
Well, I'm not saying it has meaning yet, because of course you can't get it meaning yet because you haven't thought about anything. You have to start from ground zero.
Mm-hmm. And what I'm saying though is that God is necessary to predicate all things.
But is that a conclusion that you've drawn?
No, that's necessary for any other conclusion that I've drawn.
Then where did you get that conclusion that is necessary?
He revealed that to you.
So it is a conclusion. So you're not starting with it, because if he revealed it to you, then you've already transgressed some in your existence, because you have to have contact part
of it. Right, there's circularity in all of my understanding, but there's circularity in yours too. See, because you can't understand existence in just experiments without...
I'm not saying that you can understand it, but you have to start there.
But see, that's no starting point at all.
Why not? You have to. We're enforced to.
I don't see
you
that.
Can't say a single thought or a word or without starting to exist. I mean, where?
Because what you're saying then is starting point is nothing. It's non-existent in a sense. What is existence? You got to tell me what existence is.
Well, we don't know that.
Maybe for you to just say starting point is existence.
You can't. I can't. Yeah, I think I guess my question is that. We're talking about existence here, but meaningless existence cannot be a beginning point for any epistemology. You've got to have meaningful existence. And if you have meaningful existence, you have existence, as Calvin says, as something. And he's going to argue that you cannot know yourself without knowing yourself as a creature of God, otherwise you don't know yourself truly. So, existence. Yeah, we do. I'm not quite sure I follow what you're saying either. But the point is that ontology meaningless ontology isn't any ground or beginning point for epistemology. For epistemology, you've got to have a meaningful existence. To have a meaningful existence, to rightly understand your existence, you've got to have a knowledge of yourself, but you don't know yourself purely unless you know yourself as a creature of God.
What I understand, my concern is, regardless of what you think your basis is for acting, you have to act as if something is true. And the one thing that you have to act as if it is true is your own existence. You have no choice but to act that way. You have no choice but to behave as if you exist.
Well, I would go ahead, Paul.
If I understand it, Mike is starting. He's looking at it from a, I don't know if you want
temporal priority.
If you want to start from an individual perspective,
okay.
Where does each individual begin?
Okay.
From the womb, where did my Elliot begin? He began simply by acting. he has no other choice.
Right.
Existence is, it's there.
Right.
Consequently,
but see, in order to say that, though, you're bringing in elements of being from the womb, it's hard for you to just say that. It's there.
Well, he didn't know he was from the womb. All he can do is he just begins to act.
But see, again, we have to, like Pastor Walden, I think, is going to say, epistemology deals with knowledge, not just with being.
Right.
We're talking about what we're knowing.
Mm-hmm.
See, that's the difference. It's not a matter of so much of just bare ontology.
Okay. But I guess if I'm looking at the perspective, on the one hand, you think, how do we know what we know? That's epistemology. Mm-hmm. How do I know that I exist? If I understand what Mike is saying, you don't even have to ask that question. You don't have to ask, how do I know I exist?
Well,
because you can't function as if you don't exist.
I'm saying kind of like that, in that you can't, your epistemology, you have to come to your epistemology after you exist. And I was wondering if what you were saying when you said up, epistemology is built on meaningful existence, but meaningful existence isn't arrived at without a knowledge of ourselves and God. But I thought knowledge is epistemology, how we know.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my point, is that you can't come to how you know until you just live and begin to know. And so you can't presuppose first your conclusion without having some, if you're in a vacuum otherwise.
Obviously, a non-existent entity can't presuppose anything. I mean, there has to be existence, intelligent existence, to presuppose anything. I'm not sure what the significance of that is.
There are presuppositions in your epistemology, right?
No.
In other words, what did man begin with? Have you raw scientific Are there certain foundational beliefs by which he's able to categorize them?
Just by the things that make him existent.
Is it purely empirical?
No, empiricism. Why do we kind of fear rationality?
But what is reason? Well, how would you define reason? Reason conformity to the truth?
I would say reason, what you have to start with is reason as you live your life, as you exist and live, by the standard that you live. In other words, as we talked about before, the law of non-contradiction. You know that if I live and walk outside my truck, and the truck comes in, it's going to unwield it. I live by that standard. That's something we can't escape. We just work with from day one. And then that, for those seem to be the standards that you build up from. Because that's where you exist. That's the level that you need existence in which you just move. And then from that, you find a world, and you find things, and so you find that everything has a cause. You just see things come from something else, but they don't come from themselves. And so then, that is rather, and it seems then when you're talking about, and I wrote, I was trying to look for the little note I wrote about the transcendental argument when you go back, when it was talking about, I don't know. Well, no, this was today, when we were talking about Justin, or I don't remember who it was. Anyway, and it seems to me that the transcendental argument, if it's a conclusion, then that's the evidential point right there.
I'm not sure I follow all this, but I wouldn't say the transcendental argument's conclusion. I would say the transcendental argument is an argument, but if as an argument it has a conclusion.
Does the transcendental argument attempt to prove that by presupposing God, that's the only rational explanation of all we know?
Mm-hmm. I think so.
Then wouldn't that be irrational? In other words, you're saying to somebody, if you presuppose God, it's the only way to explain everything. So the transcendental argument is therefore an argument on evidence. Because you say, I've looked at the world, the only way to understand it is that God exists. So the only way to understand anything we have to argue rightly about it is that God is to understand first that God exists. Because that validates
everything. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's an evidence. You're drawing, in other words, you're telling a person that the transcendental argument is an evidence from all of our existence that it only makes sense by God. So it's not properly presupposing God.
Well, just a second, but the evidence that the transcendental argument appeals to is the evidence as seen and as understood from a Christian point of view. People have gone so far as to try to have a world in which morality is an ultimate and other things, but that's not the world to which we're appealing. What we're appealing to is the world as it really is and as they know it really is.
So, that's the very point, isn't it? That you're able to say to the unbeliever, what you've posited is unreal, and we can prove it simply by looking at what's around us.
In a certain sense we can prove it, in a certain sense there are evidence. You see, presuppositionalism is not opposed to evidence, it's opposed to certain use and view of evidence. It's opposed to evidence as having some significance apart from the existence of God. They have no meaning, they're not properly understood unless they're understood as created by God or having a place in God's universe.
It's not denying that you use an argument to get an argument, obviously have a conclusion. I mean, you're trying to prove, Christianity.
Yeah.
But it is saying that even your very argumentation is a thing of certain Christian principles.
Uh-huh.
And the reason is not just some bare law of non-contradiction, but that law is a reflection of God's nature. So that's a conclusion by knowledge of the law. Well, see, but when I am arguing with somebody, I'm arguing as a Christian. I have to assume that they're going to say that you're assuming certain things, and I'm not going to deny that because I am a Christian. But you're not assuming them without evidence.
Of course, there's all sorts of evidence here, and the evidence and the presuppositions are inseparable. But the question is not, presuppositionalism is not opposed to the evidence, because it's opposed to a view of evidence, and it's opposed to the idea of evidence as brute fact from which you can move to no knowledge of God existence, to God existence, by looking at evidence that doesn't presuppose the existence of God.
But isn't that what, did I misunderstand, isn't that what you said the transcendental argument was? Is that you look at the evidence of God, you can have no other conclusion. It's the evidence of God, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the evidence of what we, everything we see.
Right. See, the thing is that when God converts a man, I mean, I see the evidence through the eyes of God, if God wants me to see them.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't help but see them.
And only the Christian view of the evidence is accurate and is according to reality. Only the Christian view of the evidence gives you a view of the universe that's consistent and not contradictory.
but we expect the non-Christians to be held responsible for not seeing that. They ought to see it that way.
They ought to see it that way.
They have natural abilities or no moral abilities.
Natural ability to see it, yes. And they in fact do see it when it suits them.
Right.
But
so then that would appear to be you're not arguing by presupposition because you're acknowledging that they do already know it in fact.
Oh yeah. Well, that's why I argue by presuppositions. One of my proofs for presuppositionism is that we make argument by presuppositions because those presuppositions are already known by the unbeliever. They know them already.
Now, see, the evidentialists would simply say that they know it already, but we're just using the obstacles or the things that they are constructing to.
No, that's not what the evidentialists would say. The evidentialists would say that they don't know it, and we need to show them, and we need to prove it to them.
That's
not pure evidentialism. What it is, I don't know. But evidentialism purports to move people from not knowing God to knowing God, and by an appeal to evidences. And if that's not what we're talking about, then that's something other than evidentialism.
Do you have any list of those evidences?
Oh, well, I think Clark Pinnock and John Warwick Montgomery would be two places to start.
I think Clark Pinnock has a little article that he wrote in
There's a couple of misunderstandings. First of all, is that somehow presuppositionalism is opposed to evidence. If that's not true. Presuppositionalism is opposed to evidentialism. And those are two different things. The other thing is R.C. Sproul is, in my opinion, just basically confused because he's not a consistent evidentialist, but he's not a presuppositionalist either. I think Gerstner may be, in some of his works, more consistent evidentialist. But I think that's one of the problems we're dealing with here. We're asking the question, and do people, one of the reasons I'm a presuppositionist is because I believe that people already know God and that they don't need to have God proven to them. The whole premise of evidentialism is that people don't know God and they don't know that Christianity is true and they need to have it prove it to them. My understanding of evidentialism.
So couldn't you become an evidentialism from the standpoint of yet? Couldn't you still be an evidentialist saying that, yes, people already know God, but they are truth detractors, and our job as apologists is to point out to them their own suppression of the things that they are
R.C. Sproul may be saying that. He adopts an exposition of Romans 1, which I regard as supporting presuppositionalism. That's why I regard it as inconsistent. Fact is, in classical apologetics, the other thing I would say is that it is in fact clear, and I'll show you the evidence for it as we get on into it, that the Princeton theologians, all of whom were the precursors and then forerunners of evidentialism, all taught, did not teach that men know God. That's where Sproul was distinct from. They taught probabilism. They taught that the evidence for Christianity was at best probable. That's what's meant by probabilism. And Warfield and Alexander and those before him, I admitted as much. Evidentialism is probabilistic. Man's not a probabilist, then he is being inconsistent with evidentialism. The fact is that Sproul is confused. He has both, his elements of both, presuppositionalism and evidentialism in his thinking. In fact, I think it was Frame or some other presuppositionist that actually made that point, said that there was room for dialogue between Westminster and Ligonier because school had actually moved away from the evidentialist position. Yes.
One thing I was just adding is I just recently been reading John Crane's book, Apologetics for the Glory of God. And he has a short section in there where he even, as much as he respects and loves him, he critiques a little bit of things. And in that section, he spends a great deal of time using the traditional evidentialist arguments in what he would say is a presuppositional manner, but he would be more favorable to using those and not just using the transcendental argument. So, I mean, it might interest you to just read and see how he goes on in an extended discussion and shows how he would use all of those arguments, and he thinks it's even legitimate for presuppositionalists to use those propositional intelligence. And not just to limit oneself.
Yeah, the question is not whether you use evidences or not. That's what Tom Notaro's book is all about, Vantil and the Use of Evidences. The question is how you use them. And there's some, as this conversation proves, there's some very difficult questions involved in all of this, in this discussion. But I'm going to suggest that this is 10 o'clock. We defer this discussion till next.